case number 12-5117 et al., Christopher Van Hollen Jr. versus Federal Election Commission et al., Center for Individual Freedom, appellant. Mr. Curry for appellant, Mr. Witten for appellees.
Mr. Kirby, I think we should wait until things quiet down a bit here.
May it please the court. I'm Tom Kirby, counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom. Pursuant to the court's order, I'm the only appellant's counsel who will be arguing today. There is a co-appellant that has its own brief, and regardless of any unfortunate things I may say today, they stand by whatever they've said in their briefs. Yesterday, the court asked both sides to be prepared to address two threshold issues. Was identified in an order issued yesterday afternoon. We're prepared to do so, and I will address those at the threshold, but I think it would be useful first if I take about 90 seconds to frame our view of the merits of the case, because some of my discussion of those threshold issues will relate back to that part of the case. The core of this case, this appeal, turns on step one of Chevron. And the question presented is, did Congress clearly and unambiguously intend to compel the Federal Election Commission to require corporations and labor unions engaging in implied candidate advocacy to make much broader and more burdensome disclosures than if they had expressly advocated the election or defeat of the same candidate? Now, this case is unusual because we know that Congress had no such actual intent, because when it adopted the provision dealing with disclosures for implied advocacy, in that very statute, corporations and unions were forbidden to engage in implied advocacy. This case also is unusual because it seems clear that if Congress had actually had an intent on the matter, it certainly would not have intended a topsy-turvy regime in which, if you engage in implied advocacy, you make much broader disclosures than express advocacy. Nevertheless, Congressman Van Hollen persuaded Judge Jackson that that is what Congress clearly and unambiguously intended in the statute.
And I really need for you to move to the threshold.
Let me move to the threshold.
So you understand my concerns in any event. The two seminal Supreme Court opinions on this, Diamond v. Charles and Arizonans for Official English.
Right.
I'm sure you've looked at them. They're very strong statements in Diamond. And Arizonans' court repeated, doubted very seriously that the interveners had any standing to continue, would just assume it for the purpose of getting to the mootness question, and they mooted the case out. Nonetheless, so, I mean, they're consistent. They're absolutely consistent in what they say. And the problem here for me is the court has said you can't piggyback. And we've applied this in an agency case, in the ATT consent case. We've applied the same logic and rationale. You can't piggyback if the original defendant or the original party below has moved out. You've now got to indicate how you've got standing. You have the worst scenario here because you're arguing Chevron 2, and the agency has walked away. There was no determination on Chevron 2, and the remedy you seek, I just looked at the briefs again, is to reinstate 207. And that's a Chevron 2 determination. We don't make that determination. The agency's not here to defend it. The agency is the institution that has to make that determination. So I don't see what redress you have.
Let me respond directly, Your Honor. In the cases that I'm aware of, including, for example, the Diamond case, where there has been a concern about an independent intervener continuing where the government is not appealing, it's been a situation where, if the intervener succeeded, there still was no reason to believe the intervener was going to benefit the interest that it was relying on to intervene. In Diamond, as I recall, the case involved an injunction against enforcement of some restrictions on abortion. A doctor who didn't approve of abortions had intervened sort of to vindicate his value judgment.
Beyond value, personal interest, professional interest, clients, et cetera. He stated everything he thought the court would bite on in trying to get injury in fact.
He did lay them out, but the Supreme Court ultimately pointed out that once the state decided they weren't interested in enforcing this statute, even if he reversed the injunction, he got no benefit unless the state then decided to enforce the statute that they had decided not to defend.
It was a little bit more than that, because you had a state saying our interests are aligned. Again, it's the worst scenario for you. The state in that case filed with the Supreme Court to make it clear, and the Supreme Court said they didn't care. State said our interests are aligned with the intervener. We're just not going to pursue this.
The Supreme Court's, with all respect, Your Honor, as I read the case, the ground of decision was, even if he prevailed, you couldn't be sure he would get any benefit because you didn't know how the state would enforce the statute.
Now let's take that thought, and so I can just give you my concern, and you explain to me your answer. Even if you prevail, I don't know what you get, because it's a Chevron 2 argument. We can't compel the agency that has primary jurisdiction what to do. And you're asking us to ignore that by saying, no, reinstate the rule. It hasn't been defended on Chevron 2 yet, in the district court or here. There's been no determination that it passes muster under Chevron 2. And you're saying, that's our view of the law. You have to impose that view of the law. I don't know how you get there.
Your Honor, first, with respect, the agency defended the regulation vigorously at Chevron 2 in the district court.
And they're not here.
They're not here, but their argument is being presented here. Now, the difference between us and Diamond is this. The regulation gives us protection when we engage in the kind of activity, free speech activity, that the complaint says.
The regulation.
The one that has been struck down.
Right.
Gives us protection. We don't need the FEC to do anything. As long as that regulation is in effect.
My concern is, how do we put that, on what authority do we put that regulation in place when the agency is not here saying that's the proper result? I could understand your saying, maybe, I'm thinking it through. It's a weird case.
It is a weird case.
I can understand your saying the least you got to do is strike this. The district court was wrong. We're struggling hard to distinguish Diamond and Arizona, but the district court's wrong. Strike the Chevron 1 analysis and send it back for further consideration before the district court. That's very different from saying this court should impose your view of what the regulation should be.
Let me say first, we would be happy with that outcome. We believe at step 2, the agency would successfully defend its regulation.
You're not asking. And we don't have the authority to reinstate a regulation. That's not the reinstate a regulation. Well, you're asking for something rather commonplace. Reverse the district court.
I agree, Your Honor. We were describing the effect of reversal.
You want me to read your conclusion?
No, Your Honor, we did state, please reinstate.
I want to make sure we're reading the same brief.
We're reading the same brief,
so
and I wrote
it. You ask for what Judge Randolph said you're not asking for.
Well, but what I
was a slip, right?
What I would like to say is
the secretary typed those words.
No, I wrote it. Yeah. I wrote it to make clear what we understood to be and believed to be the effect of the reversal would be to revise, because the only reason this regulation is gone is a judgment based on Chevron step 1. If this court reverses that judgment.
That's the argument to make if the agency's here, but we're playing in a different arena now. The agency's not here, and you can't ignore what the Supreme Court has said. That's why I say I can at least fathom an argument if you say you've got to reverse that, then send it back for reconsideration. Maybe I can work that through in my head. I still have some standing problems, but maybe I can work that through in my head.
The only thing the Supreme Court has decided in Arizona and in another case called Roper, which has not been mentioned, and also in the Diamond case, is that if the intervener remains, the intervener separately has to have standing when the state drops out.
That's my understanding of cases.
Do you have an injury from the district court opinion?
We do.
Is there a way of redressing it?
There is.
And what is that?
Our injury is...
Now, what's the way of redressing it?
The way of redressing it is simply to reverse the judgment below,
right,
at which point the regulation springs full flower into effect again by its own force, because it won't have been struck down, and we can rely on it.
Why does it spring?
Because it has only been...
The agency is the agency here is the only group that has the authority to determine what's in place. When they walked away from a determination that that regulation is gone, they have an effect, for whatever reasons, they have taken that off the table. Now, it may be if it goes back and the district court has to listen to new arguments because the Chevron 1 analysis is wrong, the agency may come in and say, well, we do want to defend it again. They are not defending it.
Your Honor, it gets back in part to the peculiarity of this agency, and it has many peculiarities. But this agency can only act by an affirmative vote of at least four members.
Yeah.
There has been no affirmative vote of four members to overturn this regulation or not to recognize this regulation. There has been a 3-3 deadlock, which led to no further participation in this case.
You know what I'm going to ask you. Where are they, if it's so clear?
What? I'm sorry, Your Honor. They're not here because their view is to move forward to an appeal, they have to affirmatively decide to do so. But they have. Here's my point. The agency cannot itself invalidate a validly enacted regulation.
There's no determination that it's a validly enacted regulation.
It's presumptively valid until either a court strikes it down, and this court is only step one has been used to strike this down, or until the agency, by a 4-2 vote, decides to strike the regulation and adopt a new one. That hasn't happened.
I wish it were that easy.
Well, I do too, Your Honor, but I think it is. There has been. So those are our positions here. As we understand, our position is squarely, as Judge Randolph has said, that our obligation is to show that we have standing here, which includes redressability. We believe that reversing the judgment, which is the only thing that impairs regulation, would cause the regulation to be available to us at that point to justify the way we have always done business.
Just the way the doctor in the case argued, just the way the interveners in Arizona wanted to, they made the same argument. We have strong interests here. You can't let this happen. And the court said, no, we're not buying that.
The doctor's interests there all depended on enforcement by the state, Your Honor. Here, we don't depend on enforcement by the FEC. As soon as there's a reversal.
You depend on their regulatory enforcement.
You depend upon
them writing a regulation that's consistent with your view of the law.
No, Your Honor. That regulation is in effect and hasn't been impaired. Even the agency's announcement of its position, if I can be given just a second here. The FEC never called the legality or wisdom of its regulation into question. And in its press release as to what it was going to be doing, the press release said, until such time as the Van Hollen case is resolved on appeal, here's what we're going to do. Now, you recall, the decision not to appeal was 3-3. Republicans here, Democrats here. The three Democrats blocked the appeal. Only two of them ever explained what they were doing. They didn't say the regulation was invalid or unwise or didn't meet
the FEC. None of that matters with respect to what we're talking about, because all you got to do is go back to the state case, and the state said their interests were totally aligned with the interveners, and the Supreme Court said, so what?
Still, the intervener's benefits depended upon action by the state. Ours does not, because once this regulation is back in effect, we can rely on it. Once this decision below, the judgment below, is reversed, then the regulation is effective. There's nothing impairing the validity of that regulation. The FEC never voted to impair that regulation. So we can rely on it, we can do what we want, and we can assert it as a defense. That's our standing. And,
your standing is, in other words, you want to be able to piggyback the position, as the Supreme Court called it, onto the agency, ride that, and argue for them what you think is the correct view of the law. And I don't see the Supreme Court saying you can do that.
Yeah, Mr. Kirby, can I move on? I want to ask you, you said that we can rely on this regulation. And I have read the regulation, and I'm not sure that it is as broad as both sides here are saying it is, that it deals with all disclosure from electioneering communications. It seems to me the regulation says pursuant to, if a corporation makes a disbursement pursuant to 114.15, and I'm sure you're familiar with 114.15, which was adopted in the wake of Wisconsin Right to Life.
Right.
If I'm a corporation and I throw an ad out, and the ad is names a candidate and is the functional equivalent of express advocacy, what's my disclosure obligation under the regulations?
It would be under the 2007 regulation, Your Honor. The reason being,
How can it be that I have then, in this hypo that I've just given you, the hypothetical I've just given you, I am not making a disbursement pursuant to 114.15, because that only, 114.whatever, only deals with situations that are not the functional equivalent.
No, Your Honor, with respect, it deals with situations that are not express advocacy. What happened with respect to...
That's not what it says. It says pursuant to 114.15, right. And that only deals with Wisconsin Right to Life type advocacy.
I've got to admit, Your Honor, that this is an issue that has not come up before, and it's one that I don't have in my head to help you with. But I'll tell you this.
Before you go on, has the Federal Election Commission ever rendered an interpretation of the scope of this particular sub 9?
Not with respect to the issue you're raising anyway, no, Your Honor.
I mean, this ties in with Judge Edwards' concern, it seems to me, is that would you agree that before we can make a determination about the reasonableness of this regulation, assuming that it's not compelled by the plain meaning of the statute, we have to know what the regulation means, don't we?
Yes.
And the only way we're going to get that information is from the Federal Election Commission. Otherwise, we wind up interpreting it ourselves.
Well, and that, I guess, could produce a remand to the Federal Election Commission or some sort of discovery of the Federal Election Commission.
There is a doctrine called primary jurisdiction that allows us to do that.
But in the meantime, Your Honor, our position is simply this. There's a regulation out there that's presumptively valid.
Oh, you just got finished saying you don't know what it means.
You walked
over to the Edwards position, and you realized you were getting close, and you said, "No, I don't want to be there. Let me move back."
No, I'm not. I'm not concerned that at all, Your Honor.
We don't know what this thing means. That's the problem. Judge Randolph and I are.
Judge Randolph,
you are certainly concerned about. Are suggesting that we understand this regulation?
Well, I'm sorry for speaking over the court. First, I apologize.
No, go ahead.
Secondly, Judge Randolph has asked a technical question that, to my knowledge, no one has ever raised. And I don't know the answer to it, although I will find out if there's an answer to it.
Let me suggest to you that in preparing this case, the three of us found a lot of technical questions that we can't answer.
Well,
and I think what Judge Rand, my colleague, is saying to you is we're very nervous about suggesting to anyone that we have the answer to this, and it's not our responsibility to offer it.
And I don't ask you to, Your Honor. All I ask the court to say is, number one, the Chevron Step 1 ruling was error and should be set aside. That then leaves the regulation in effect. Even if as I said, Judge Randolph has raised a question I'm going to have to look into. But I know that my client also engages in electioneering communications that are not the functional equivalent of express advocacy, but do mention candidates and clearly are protected by this regulation.
That is the one category that clearly is within the regulation.
And there's no question that my client does it and wants to continue doing it and doesn't want to disclose all its donors when it does it. So we have standing to pursue a challenge to the Chevron Step 1 ruling. Your Honor, I have a brief full of arguments why Chevron Step 1 should not have produced, but I think the court has obviously paid a lot of attention, so I propose to sit down.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Roger Witten for Congressman Van Hollen. As much as we would like to jump on the Judge Edwards bandwagon, we can't in good conscience persuade ourselves that the defendant here lacks Article III standing. That is the question under Diamond v. Charles, and it seems to us that the appellants here could benefit from a lifting of the vacator, and that therefore they have a concrete stake under Article III that's redressable. And we think that as much as we'd like to reach the opposite conclusion, that is our conclusion at this point. The question, Judge Randolph and other members of the panel, is whether under Chevron Step 1, the unambiguous language of the statute forecloses the position that the FEC took. Whether there are other ambiguities or other problems or other uncertainties is irrelevant if the plain language taken together with its context and its legislative history unambiguously foreclosed the tacking on of a purpose test. And it's our position that the district court was right in concluding that that was the case under Chevron Step 1. The starting point for Chevron Step 1 analysis, of course, is the language of the statute. And then you consider the context in the legislative history. And indisputably, when you look at the language of 434F2F, you don't find a purpose requirement on the face of the statute. Congress did not add one. What Congress said was pretty clear. It said that BCRA's disclosure requirements are applicable to every person who makes an electioneering communication, and Congress defined the term person to include corporations and unions. Congress required of every such person that they disclose, quote, all contributors who contributed. The ordinary meaning of the word contributor does not include a requirement that the contributor harbor or express a specific subjective intent.
And for that proposition, you rely on what?
Common usage, dictionaries, and the plain meaning of the word.
Let's take dictionaries. What is a contributor?
Contributor is someone who
makes a contribution.
Gives to in common with others.
What's a contribution?
What's a contribution? It's not for these purposes the way the Congress defined it in 431A8.
It's not what Congress defined.
It is not.
What about Webster's dictionary, Third International, Second International, choose? What is the definition of a contribution?
Well, I can't quote it, but I believe it's to give or grant in common with to give or grant in common with others, and the contribution is what is given or granted.
The OED you rely on too. What's the definition of contribution in the OED?
Roughly the same.
Here's the OED definition, the act of lending aid to bring about a result. And Webster's in the Third International and Second International says that a contribution is to give money for a specified object. So the specified object and the result, according to the regulation, is putting on an ad. Why is that in any way contrary to the plain meaning of 434F?
The plain meaning of 434F2F, if you look at the language and you look at the statutory context and you look at the legislative history, is to cause corporations and unions to disclose all contributors who contributed. Right. If you look at 434F2E, there's an express purpose requirement because the words for an account for electioneering communications is set forth by Congress plainly on the face of the statute. If you look at 434C2C with respect to the disclosure of independent expenditures, Congress specifically said for the purpose of furthering independent expenditures. Here, Congress did not include such specific language at all. And I know there's a canon of statutory construction that is points in any direction you want, but there is one recently affirmed by this court in Coalition for Responsible Regulation that says if there you find something specific in one section and it's omitted in the other, you don't assume that it is implied in the other. And that powerful indication that Congress did not intend by using the word contributor to mean that the contributor had to harbor or express a specific intent.
That's the way the dictionaries define contribution. In part, there are other definitions, but the district judge, although we don't owe any deference, it's de novo review. The district judge said, well, the only way you can possibly read contribute or contributor, and I take it contribution, is that you're giving the money and you don't have any say, you don't want to designate it for any particular purpose. That's a contribution. But the dictionaries define it otherwise, and the Federal Election Commission certainly had leeway to consider that.
But what purpose, Your Honor, would 434F2E have, which has a specific for an account that's designated for electioneering communications? What purpose would it have if a purpose requirement were implied in 434F2F? It would have none.
Well, Congress certainly was not considering corporations and labor unions when it passed 434F, because they were prohibited at that time.
Well, it was considering some MCFL and possibly 501c4.
In fact,
527.
Yeah, when you think about it, if 434F did apply to corporations and labor unions at that time, it would probably be unconstitutional under the Fifth Amendment, because it would require them to incriminate themselves.
Well,
they have to disclose the fact that that they were doing something that the statute made a criminal offense.
Congress spoke very clearly. It said all persons. It defined persons to include corporations and labor unions.
Go ahead, finish it.
It had in mind that the statute would apply to certain corporations, and depending on the fate of the Wellstone Amendment, might apply to a broader class of corporations, but
let me finish this thought. What do we do in F with if the disbursements? What does the disbursements refer to?
The disbursements were made by the person to fund electioneering communications.
Well, then, doesn't that inform? Can't an agency say that? That informs the meaning of contributors? We're talking about the disbursements. That's the beginning of F.
I think
the disbursements are producing and airing electioneering communications, right?
The disbursements are by the person to make an electioneering communication.
The disbursements. What does the disbursements mean? That goes to the direct cost of producing and airing electioneering communications, right?
Yes. By the person who's making the electioneering communications.
But can't we give meaning to contributors if we start with if the disbursements? Is it not reasonable for an agency to say contributors is with reference to the nature of the disbursements?
It's not impossible, but it's worth.
Do you think that's a stretch?
I do think it's a stretch.
Really?
I think it's a stretch when you look at 434F2E and when you look at 434C2C and we look at the way the word contributor is normally used and defined. And I would point out that as good or as bad as an idea as that may be, Judge Edwards, it was not articulated by the agency. And this is an APA review of an agency regulation.
Don't get me going on what the agency's position is, okay? I have no idea what the agency's position is.
Well, the agency didn't say the statute was ambiguous. It didn't say that the word disbursements informed the meaning of contributor. It didn't say point to, in fact, any language in the text of the statute as the basis for the purpose test. It said it was relying on what it identified as the purpose underlying the statute, but it never said what the purpose was.
Okay. I got your answer. Thank you.
Understanding that we may not all be in agreement as to the ordinary meaning of contributor, the motions panel pointed out, and I that nothing in the text of 434F2F itself supports the proposition that Congress intended any other than the ordinary meaning.
Well, that's
let's
not,
look at
that's not really accurate. It's one thing for you to say the agency didn't play out the connection between disbursements and contributors. That's one thing. It's quite another thing to say you can't get that read there. So, I mean, I don't know whether I agree with the emotions panel suggesting that there's nothing in the literal. There are terms in F that clearly would support the view that you don't like.
Well, I don't want to be heard to concede that the reference to disbursements informs the meaning of the word contributor. The sense of this statute is there are two things you can do here if you're a person making electioneering communication. You can take the very easy step of setting up a separate account, and people who want to support your electioneering communications are contributors who contributed to that account for electioneering communications. You just disclose them. And there's another, if you don't want to set up a separate account for some reason, you disclose everybody whose funds you use for electioneering communications. And that, I think, helps understand what the way the word disbursement is used. What would be the point of 434 F2F if it meant the same thing as 434 F2E?
See,
and what would Congress,
another problem.
Excuse me.
You've got another problem in addition to the just the language itself. And the other problem is that the result that you're arguing for makes no sense, because independent expenditures, which are defined in the statute as express advocacy without coordination with a candidate or a political party, the only thing you have to disclose when you engage in express advocacy is what? Contributions that you receive for the purpose of allowing you to put those ads on.
It's because Congress used the words for the purpose,
right?
There, but not here.
But well, that's right. So if all you do is put on an ad that's sort of like issue-oriented and is really not the functional equivalent, it's not advocating a candidate for or against, it's just basically an issue ad, although it mentions a candidate, then you've got to disclose the kitchen sink. Why would that? So the narrow disclosure is when you're engaging and when you're trying to defeat somebody or get them elected, and the broad disclosure is when the only thing you're doing is talking about an issue. That makes no sense at all.
I don't know why it doesn't make sense a priori.
Because this is a Federal Election Act. And the disclosure is supposed to be for the public to know who's supporting what candidate. More disclosure when there is no support of a candidate, and less disclosure when there is. That makes no sense.
Judge Randolph, you may think so, and whether I do or not doesn't matter, but Congress didn't think so. And to the extent that somebody makes the argument that this statute is upside down, it doesn't have to do with the interpretation of the statute. It's a policy issue that is addressed to Congress and not to this court.
That assumes your interpretation is correct. That's the point. Yeah, I mean, you can make that. I understand your argument, but the assumption that you're making is that your reading of contributors who contribute is the correct reading. And that's what we're trying to decide. So you're assuming the issue.
Well, to a certain extent, of course I do. In addition to the language of the statute, which we're debating vigorously, in addition to the structural context, the 434F2E and 434C2C points, of course in Chevron 1 you look at the evident objectives as Congress has reflected in the legislative history. That's one of the traditional tools of statutory analysis. Nothing in the legislative history suggests that Congress intended what has happened here. An Orwellian construction of the words all contributors, which in practice, as the FEC has admitted in paragraph 30 of its answer, has come to mean no contributors. Now, why would Congress have done that?
How has it come to mean no contributors?
Well, because what this regulation has done is encourage and facilitate circumvention of the statute, because corporations can expediently follow the policy, and unions, of don't ask, don't tell. I don't ask you what your purpose is. You don't tell me what your purpose is. I take your money. I use it on electioneering communications.
And you
I don't have to disclose.
You can use it for anything. I mean, the by the way, I'm not even sure I understand what a donation to a corporation is. If you're talking about a manufacturing corporation or a service corporation, other than this kind of Massachusetts for Life type corporation, but I'm not clear about that. I don't want to get into that, but that's another area. But it's commonplace for people to make donations. For example, I make a donation or a contribution to my alma mater every year, but I earmark it for certain things because I want the money spent that way, and that's a very common practice. So, and anybody that does that under this statute will have their name disclosed if they're earmarking it for political ads. Isn't that correct?
If they contribute, if the corporation or union sets up a separate account and the contributor gives money for that account, or if it otherwise, and gives money, makes a donation directly to that account, which is for electioneering communications, it's disclosed under E. Under F, if he makes a donation, it has to be disclosed as an anti-circumvention measure, because otherwise the intent and purpose reflected in E would be bypassed. Mm. Why would Congress set up a disclosure provision, an alternative disclosure provision in F, that was so easily evaded? If that comes back to why there is no purpose requirement in F that's implied, when there's one that's express, one inch up the page in E. Let me turn, if I could, to Chevron 2. The FEC, as I began to say earlier, posited two rationales for adding the purpose test: mitigating the supposed burdens corporations and unions would endure if they had to disclose, quote, all contributors, as the statute requires, and secondly, limiting disclosure to those persons who actually support the message conveyed. We would submit that both rationales are irrational and do not pass Chevron Step 2 muster or the arbitrary and capricious test, which is close to but not the same. First, both of those rationales are grounded on the absurd premise that the word contributors includes, quote, vast numbers, unquote, of customers, shareholders, and lenders. Nothing in the language or the legislative history of the statute remotely suggests that or remotely supports the straw man concern, and this goes to your point, Judge Randolph, that if someone walks into a hardware store and spends $1,000 on lumber, nails, and hammers, that person is a contributor. So it was irrational for the FEC to imagine that corporations and unions would endure great burdens sorting between sales receipts and contributions or donations.
What if in the labor union situation, you know what Beck rights are?
Excuse?
Beck rights?
I don't.
Oh.
Should I?
I mean, An individual who is not a member of the union and Judge Edwards is the expert on this, in a state that allows, what do they call it, union shops, has the right to not pay the portion of the, has to pay dues, union dues, but has the right not to pay the portion of the union dues that's for political, that's used for political purposes, okay? So if you, in those states, one might say that all of the money that a union receives in the way of dues from non-members is that portion, that political portion, is a donation because the individual has the option of not of not making that. In those cases, the number, I mean, the unions are only about 8% of the workforce now, but the numbers would be enormous on the, if everything had to be disclosed that wasn't, even though it wasn't designated for the purpose of political ads, just for unions, is all I'm talking about. So the FEC is right, isn't it?
Well, it didn't say any of that. It talked about vast numbers of customers, shareholders, and lenders. And I'm just not familiar enough with the Beck rights and how they might work to give you a helpful answer on that, I'm afraid. But the second reason, both rational, if I see my red lights on, but if I could just complete this thought, I'd be grateful. The second reason that the both rationales adduced by the agency are irrational is that they don't take into account the very easy alternative of establishing a separate separate account under sub E, one inch up the page. Third, there's no objective data in the administrative record to support the findings that there would be burdens. The FEC did not consider the Beck issue, as I recall, or that those burdens would be substantial enough to warrant the addition of a purpose test. And finally, the FEC's conclusion is arbitrary and capricious under Shays 3 because the FEC did not give any consideration to whether the purpose test would facilitate evasion of the statute, which it has admitted has, but it has admitted that since the adoption of the statute, there's been virtually no disclosure by corporations or unions of where they're getting their money for electioneering communications.
Mr. Whitten, respectfully, I just want to make sure, because I think your argument in the last 5 minutes ignores some of what was being suggested earlier. I would be completely uncomfortable, and I'm going to tell you in candor, in this court in any way weighing Chevron 2, arbitrary and capricious, and the agency's not here. And if those cases that you say don't apply here say anything, they certainly suggest that would be completely inappropriate for us to make a determination on Chevron 2. That's not what's on appeal. We don't have the agency here defending itself on that position, and I can't comprehend how an Article III court in our position would then weigh in on that. Can't imagine it. I hear your arguments, and I understand the arguments. We spent a lot of time in this case, but there's another side to this. That is the appropriate role of the judiciary, and in this posture of the case, that seems, so that you understand, seems to me totally inappropriate.
On that ground, I'm not going to take you on, but I think it's clear the court has the power to consider that Chevron 2 argument should it wish to do that. Rather than remand to the district court.
Okay. Let me ask you one question before you sit down. Do you know whether the commission, in order to defend itself when it's sued in a district court, has to vote by a majority vote?
I don't know.
There's no indication that I've seen in the record that there was any commission vote to defend itself in the district court. But, of course, there was a vote 3-3 on the question of appeal.
Right. You know, I don't have any recollection that there was a vote, and I'm guessing, but underscore guessing, that they didn't need a vote to defend themselves when they're sued. But I'll have to.
You certainly had to show up.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Kirby, you didn't have any time left. Did he have time left? Oh, well, good. We'll give you 2 minutes. We're generous.
On the merits, the court has thought far beyond anything I might contribute, and so I have only sort of two housekeeping matters to address. First, two questions by Judge Randolph. First, Judge Randolph, my younger, slimmer, and more handsome colleagues tell me that there's abundant FEC materials indicating that they interpret that regulation to apply to all electionary communications and not just ones that are functionally equivalent to express advocacy. But since there seems to be no dispute that we engage in at least some electionary communications that would be benefited by the regulation, it may not matter. If the court would like me to try to assemble some of that material, I would be glad to do it, but I'm inclined to rely on the fact that there's no dispute that we would get, we do at least some things that this regulation would protect. Secondly, as to the question about whether there's a necessary vote for the agency to defend itself in the district court, our understanding, my understanding from years of this, is that no such vote is necessary. FEC counsel shows up in the first instance to defend the agency, but then when it comes to whether we're going to take an appeal, that's a step that requires a vote. The third thing I would simply say is this. I make no presumptions as to how the court will rule, but I point out that there is an election coming and that the invalidation of this rule has caused problems with respect to core political speech. If the court is of the view that the district court erred in invalidating this regulation, we would ask the court as soon as it conveniently can to correct that error so that speech can proceed as appropriate. With that, I thank the court very much.
Thank you.